I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Jenny Parks. She is the president and CEO of the New Mexico Community Foundation. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So the New Mexico Community Foundation, we've talked to the Santa Fe Community Foundation. Community foundations are something that every state has. What is yours about?
Our foundation's been around 30 years next year, and we're a statewide community foundation. And the founders of the foundation really wanted to have a community foundation that serve the most vulnerable communities in the state. And they saw that really as rural communities, and that includes some of our native communities. And so while we fund organizations in urban areas, we really try to emphasize those organizations that are working in rural areas and bringing resources to rural areas. We also are a little bit different than most community foundations, and we're called a hybrid community foundation because we also really try to work in communities to help bring local leadership and build collaborations to take on tough problems affecting that community. And so we actually have program staff that works in and with communities to do that.
As you and I were talking about before we went on the air, New Mexico has some not very happy distinctions as being ranked lowest in a whole bunch of different areas. We're not doing so great in education and in teenage pregnancy and things like that.
Correct. And there just came out a new statistic that New Mexico is number one in the country for accidental deaths, which is partially the result of drug overdose and also partially the result of drunk driving accidents and other reasons. But there's good news to be had out there, and I'd like to share some of that with you because I have the opportunity to travel all around the state in this job talking to nonprofits and to community groups and citizen leaders, and it's really pretty amazing how much innovation and how much good work is happening out and around New Mexico, primarily just through people's generosity and people's desire to do something good and help other people out.
It's very interesting when you think about the kind of messages that we get in the news, which one of the main messages we get in the news is banker greed, you know, and there is this kind of false conclusion that I think people tend to draw from that, which is human nature is really greedy. Mm-hmm. And there is that strain, but this subculture of generosity, which you see, manifests in so many different ways, and people don't get medals for it.
Absolutely right, Mary Shirley. They don't get medals for it, and a lot of times they don't get recognized for it. But you know, the great thing about it is most of them don't do it because they want to be recognized. They do it because of a sense of goodness and about being something and doing something that's greater than themselves. And I think you see this in your own life, I'm sure, as other people do, just in your day-to-day life of kindness to another person or receiving kindness, and it makes you feel good about yourself. It also, when there's a need, I think there's a lot of people who just have that generosity. I mean, you know, America is really a very generous country. We're one of the top philanthropic countries in the world, really.
Yeah, and I think to that needs to be added the fact that our government doesn't do a lot of things that governments are supposed to do.
That's correct. So there needs to be a safety net that has a lot of holes in it at this point, that if it weren't filled by the churches and by the nonprofit sector, would be very detrimental to our society as a whole.
Yeah. So what are some examples of this kindness and generosity that you see in your travels around the state?
Well, I've got a couple that I would like to share with you. One is in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and there's a group there called Lions Crane Reading Foundation. And that reading foundation is run completely by volunteers. It's these old guys, actually. They're like in their 80s. And they realized that a lot of kids who were not at reading proficiency weren't at reading proficiency because they weren't smart or because they weren't getting the instruction they needed, but actually they were having a difficult time reading, that they had problems with their eyes or the way that their eyes read. And so they developed a whole program around it using really advanced computer technology where they can track eyes while you're reading and they can see what's happening. And then they have a whole program to help develop those skills in your eyesight. And so the result has been, just one example is an elementary school in a little town called Santa Clara, New Mexico. And this is not Santa Clara tribe
right
up here. It's in the south, where 28% of its fourth grade students only were reading proficiently. So that meant that you know, 72% were not. After 1 year, the fourth grade students improved to 46% of proficient readers, and then after 2 years, it was at 84% proficient readers.
Because but that's not because their eyes were all defective.
Yeah, a lot of the students in that fourth grade class were tested, and it was found out. It's not that they're defective. It's that everyone reads in a different way, and so a regular eye test wouldn't detect what was going on for a child's vision. So it's not an obvious thing that you would look for, but it's actually had great results in a number of schools in the southern part of the state. And again, this is run completely on a volunteer basis. They accept donations, of course, but most of the work they do it out of just a sense of wanting to help these kids be better readers and be more successful in school.
And a bunch of 80-year-old gentlemen came up with this computer technology?
Yeah, they did, actually. And,
that's so awesome.
Yeah, it was really awesome. So
what's your role in that?
We've funded them. We have given them grants in the past to help pay for some of the equipment and computer equipment that they use, because once they are able to see how the eyes are working or not working, there are actually computer programs that they use that they put them through to train them to make their eyes read more appropriately.
Right.
So that's one example. Another great example, I'll take you to the northern part of the state, to a little town called Theroux. And Theroux is mostly Navajo.
Theroux, spelled Thoreau.
Spelled Thoreau, pronounced Theroux. It's on the way to Gallup from Albuquerque. And between October of 2009 and October 2010, there were 15 teenagers in that community that took their lives. And that's a small community.
Oh,
we're talking about 4,800 people over a 484 square mile area. And this is, Native children killing themselves at a very young age. There was a young woman who had been part of Teach for America who was ending her period there and decided she had to do something. So she started the Theroux Community Center to try to help prevent youth suicides and to also try to really help bring families into the discussion about their children's health and the health of the family. And so she has pieced together through duct tape and rubber bands. She was able to get an abandoned building, and they were able to get some grants from the county to rebuild it, but really on a very shoestring budget. And she's really dedicated herself, and now they've been able to hire a director who's from that community. And they're doing a number of things. They have all these after-school programs. They have health fairs. They have computers that people can use and internet access. They have basketball courts for kids. And so it's really become a sort of a center of the town with family. And it was just because this one young woman wanted to do something to help. And since they opened their doors in 2010, they've had zero youth suicides
That
community. And they've referred 7 youth to counseling services, some of whom were suicidal. So it's really been effective in helping improve the lives of people that live in this area.
And so you contributed a few rolls of duct tape to the cost.
Yeah. And also provided her with technical assistance and help. You know, a lot of these nonprofits that are in rural communities, they're so isolated, and they don't really have the support that we see in bigger towns like Santa Fe or in Albuquerque, where there's a whole network of nonprofits and nonprofit professionals. So part of our role is to really try to help build sustainability and capacity in nonprofits throughout the state. We're a huge state, oftentimes many hours away from a central area. And then there's a lot of parts of the state that don't have fast or even good internet access. So they're very isolated. And so that's why it's sometimes hard to find these stories, because you don't know about them, because you don't know what's happening out there.
We're talking to Jenny Parks of the New Mexico Community Foundation. Now, there are some people who took it upon themselves to really address childhood leukemia.
Yes, we work with a family, and this can show you the power of philanthropy in our state. This is a couple from Santa Fe that had a grandson named Bodie who got leukemia several years ago, and he went to the UNM Children's Hospital, and because they had the means to send him to a center of excellence, he was able to go to Sloan Kettering where he received a blood transfusion. So he needed a blood transfusion. While he was in the UNM hospital, they befriended several families who were also there whose children had leukemia. And those children's families did not have the means to send their child to a center of excellence. Instead, I think they went to the University of Phoenix and some other places to get the blood transfusions, and in the end, it turns out that they died. This couple, their grandson was successful in his blood transfusion. He's a happy, healthy boy now. And they just felt like they wanted to make sure that every family had the opportunity to send their child or grandchild to a center of excellence, and they had the means to do that. So through a partnership with the New Mexico Community Foundation and the Children's Cancer Fund out of Albuquerque and the University of New Mexico Children's Hospital, we have a program where if a child has leukemia or another blood cancer, their family can apply for assistance for the kinds of items that insurance doesn't pay for, rent assistance, transportation, anything they really need that would prevent them from going to a place of excellence with their child. And they so far have helped 17 families and have spent quite a bit of money to do that. And it's really just simply because they want to make sure that everyone had the opportunity that their child, their grandchild had. So it's really a lovely story.
Now, the money came from this family, but the program was administered by you, the New Mexico Community Foundation?
Correct. So they have a donor advised fund with us, which we've sort of customized for their needs, and they continue to fund it to this day and hope to see it go on into perpetuity, really.
There's another family foundation, I think, or family that decided to give money to people who were going to college and who might not be able to afford college.
Yes, we administer several scholarships all around the state, and one of the most significant is the Chase Scholarship. And Mr. Chase, Mac Chase, made his fortune in oil and gas down in Artesia and has formed a foundation that gives scholarships to anyone who graduates from Artesia High School with a 3.0 GPA, and he will pay their costs for their tuition up to a certain level, but basically almost all of their tuition costs, if they're going to a New Mexico college, it would cover all their tuition.
But if they were going to Harvard, it might not.
It might not cover it if they're going to Harvard. But he'll do this for them as long as they keep a certain GPA while they're in college. And last year, he gave out $1.2
million. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, in these scholarships for these kids. And so it's a real amenity and asset for the state of New Mexico and for that community.
And I have to say, and it's a beautiful thing, and it's also, once again, almost every other country in the world has public education,
right,
that's functional and that people can afford or that's free.
Right.
And in the United States, we have to have this great song and dance about letting people even go to college.
And it's getting worse.
And
because
it's getting worse.
As you've read in the paper, of course, the tuition rates are rising, and we're getting more and more into a society that can't afford college or don't want to put themselves under such a huge financial burden of all the loans they have to take out to get through college, especially when at the end of it, right now especially, there's not a big job market for college graduates.
Exactly.
So it's really, I think, short-sighted on our part as a community and as a society, because we're going to have a bunch of people who either couldn't afford or didn't have access to college. I mean, fortunately, we do have our community colleges, and I think we have an excellent one here in Santa Fe that can help with that somewhat, but I'm afraid we're creating this kind of divided, even more divided culture or society where we have people who do have a lot of means who can go to the Harvards and the Browns, and then those who don't, who can't even go to UNM because they may not be able to afford it.
And the reality is, if you do go to one of those expensive colleges, your loans when you get out are the equivalent of what I think of as a mortgage payment.
Right.
And they go on for probably as long as a mortgage. So that means those people, instead of buying a house, have to just pay their loans back.
Right. And a lot of times they can't get jobs at a level or at a pay that even allows them to pay them back. Allows them to pay them back, but that's all they can do. So it's really, it's a pretty severe problem right now that I think is going to get worse.
We're talking to Jenny Parks from the New Mexico Community Foundation. Now, how do you, I mean, some of the examples you just described are wealthy families who gave money and are doing things like the scholarship and so on. But other than that, how does the foundation get the money that it then gives out?
Well, really, anyone can be a philanthropist. And I use that expression broadly. Philanthropy is actually a Greek word meaning the love of man. And I think really all of us are philanthropists. I mean, if you don't have to be a Warren Buffett or a Bill Gates to be a philanthropist. You can do it just by giving of your time, giving of your kindness, and, of course, giving of your money. And an example of that, of course, is the group out of Las Cruces, the Lion's Crane, or Juliana Coe. So we really deal with all kinds of levels of giving, from people giving. One example is people giving $5 to help Santa Clara replant the Santa Clara Canyon that was destroyed during the Las Conchas fire last summer. We actually have a number of emergency funds. We call ourselves philanthropic first responders,
right?
Because we have emergency funds that try to be really responsive to crises in the communities that we're serving all around the state, and help them when, you know, either from fires or, like last year, there was a gas shortage in northern New Mexico, and a lot of people had to be displaced for a while because they couldn't get heat. And so one of our great examples of that and generosity from people who don't have a lot of money is the Santa Clara fire. It actually, we asked people to give $5 to $10 to donations to plant trees, and we probably had maybe 500 donors give that those different levels of amount, but it's ended up that they've been able to raise about $140,000 to plant seedlings. So the money comes in all different ways. It comes from people who are wealthy. It comes from people who aren't quite so wealthy. I think the important thing is the act of giving, and then the pooling the resources. That's another thing that a community foundation can really help do, is pool resources from a variety of people to have a larger impact. And so we really try to focus on that.
I read an article on the internet. I cannot remember where it came from, but it said something like, money brings happiness as long as you give it away.
Well, actually, I think they've done studies on that.
Yeah.
That is really true, that even if you think of someone who may not be philanthropic in the way that you think about it, in terms of just like giving to a charity or a nonprofit, I think it brings people a lot of pleasure to do for their family or to provide opportunities for their friends or for relatives or something through their earnings and through the work that they've done. And so I think that that is a very true thing, that there's no, I mean, there's a certain point of having money if, you know, you can do a lot more fun things or buy certain things, but that buying of certain things is such a short-lived happiness.
Yeah, it wears right out.
You crave something, then you get it, and then you're ready for the next thing, right? So the longer-lasting satisfaction seems to come from really being able to do for other people.
Tell us about the challenge that happened in Embuto, New Mexico.
Yeah, so Embuto is a wonderful little community, of course, between Taos and Velarde, and it's
that we've all driven by.
That you've all driven by, right by Dixon, and the town many years ago had all volunteer library was formed, and it was really just in this kind of small little building that they got people to donate books. It was very small, and then one of the community members, who remained anonymous, worked through us, through the community, New Mexico Community Foundation, and said, I will put up a challenge to the community to buy this piece of land where we could then have a bigger, better library. And it was about, I think it was $200,000, and the community actually raised it in a very short period of time, in less than a month. And so they were able to purchase this land.
Well, a small community raising a huge amount of
very
money.
Very small community. And they really understood the importance of having a community center. And that's what the Embuto Valley Library has become. So if next time you're driving up there, instead of just whizzing by on your way to Taos, stop in. They have a radio station there now that a lot of kids programs done. They do after-school reading programs. They have an early childhood reading program. They were able to buy the building next door, which is now a food co-op. They have internet. They have hundreds and hundreds of wonderful books, magazines. And it truly has become the center of their community. And you can see, again, what can happen when a few people get together with a really good idea and are willing to give of themselves and their time and their energy and their funds to make it happen. And the libraries, you know, this is sort of a common story. There's several wonderful rural libraries throughout the state. There's one in Truchas and all over, actually, Vista Grande Library out in El Dorado. They're all over the state, and they really, in each community, they are their own expression, but they really become community centers. And so it's inspiring to see a small group of people be able to change their town like that.
It also is about something that I think is so important that we don't talk about enough, which is non-commercial public space.
Exactly. And there's a shortage of it, and you don't
totally.
Even, yeah. And we just had the lovely woman here from Collected Works came by and said hi to us. And she was just telling me that their space at Collected Works, they've always wanted it to be a free community space where there can be an exchange of ideas, where people could come together. And so those kinds of spaces are so important for a strong
right.
democracy, really.
It really is. And that's a store. So in a sense, it's a commercial space, but like a library. And the kinds of places that you're talking about, the center that was built to help prevent teen suicide,
right.
are places where it's really not about feeling like you need to buy something.
Right.
It's about being with people.
Right. And sharing ideas and sometimes being quiet, you know, reading or just having a place to go and to not be isolated. You know, that's another issue that really impacts us in New Mexico because we're such a big state and we're so sparsely populated, which is wonderful about us. We all, you know, appreciate that. But at the same time, it can be very isolating for people, and especially people living in these smaller rural communities that maybe not have the ability to go to a bigger urban center or something. And so these little community spaces become sort of like a lifeline for them in all actuality,
right.
To, you know, be known and to have a community and that sort of thing. And so that's a wonderful thing about libraries in general, but also a wonderful thing about some of these small community rural libraries.
We're talking to Jenny Parks, who is the president and CEO of the New Mexico Community Foundation. Now, you're telling us so many interesting stories from all around the state, and I mean, we could be here for the next 5 hours talking about all the adventures that you've had and all the things that you've seen and the kindness and generosity. Let's talk about another one that's happening in Silver City.
Yeah, Silver City really has a lot of innovation going on, and I was just down there recently meeting with the Wellness Coalition and then the Volunteer Center for Grant County, and it was really exciting to hear about a program that, again, is all volunteer-driven. And Alicia Edwards is the head of the Volunteer Center for Grant County, and she was able to find a group of women with the LDS Church, the Mormon women, who were willing to help some of these isolated seniors. We were talking earlier about the isolation that can occur in rural communities. And there are a lot of homebound people who are seniors. And so these Mormon women for the last year have been cooking all volunteer, and then they freeze the food, and then the food is taken down to the very, very tiny boot in the southwest corner of New Mexico so that these folks at least once a week get a home-cooked meal in their home. And there's other kinds of food assistance that they're trying to bring to them. But as our population ages, part of the, you know, hunger issues in the state, it's not just children, it's also our seniors who maybe don't have a lot of means or who are unable to drive or who are aging and have a hard time getting out and about and that sort of thing. So it's something that was addressed by the community. They saw the need, and these women who've been cooking these meals do it without any compensation, and they've been doing it for a whole year gladly. And it's a wonderful way to connect people who want to do something good with people who could use it.
Now, when they bring the food to these homebound seniors, do they also hang out with them a little bit, keep them company?
Yeah, they spend a little time with them, make sure they're doing okay, see if there are certain needs that they have or if they need to refer them to some sort of social service. You know, and it's good. You know, some of these people don't have anyone that live with them at all and are really isolated, and so someone's checking in with them weekly to make sure they're still there, they're doing okay. And that's invaluable, too, just the human connection that they make and making someone know that they're important and that they matter.
Yeah. There is a lot of work that you guys are doing for women and girls
yes.
in the state.
Yes, we are. We have actually just finished an initiative that we worked on for about 4 years called Women Building Community. And that was a $1 million investment in women and girls in our state. And it was really focused on women of color-led organizations organizing around reproductive justice. We now are expanding that to really make it a broader umbrella for women and girls. We're calling ourselves the Fund for Women and Girls, and we have a website. It's called newmexicowomen.org. That's under we're building it right now. This is a really new initiative of ours, but the idea is to be a statewide grant maker that really supports women and girls to lead self-sufficient, healthy, and empowered lives. And it's really helping our girls realize their full potential. You know, once again, unfortunately, New Mexico has a lot of bad statistics around the status of our women and our girls. And yet, it's different in different parts of the state. So some of the issues maybe in the southern part of the state are not exactly the same as they are in the northern part of the state. So what we're doing right now...
Well, give us some examples of those differences.
Well, for example, Hobbs, New Mexico, has the highest teen pregnancy rate in the state, which, as you know, teen pregnancy is second highest in New Mexico in the whole nation. But I wouldn't have expected that Hobbs would have the highest, and it does. And so...
Do they know why? Is it like abstinence? Sex education, is that pretty much it?
Well, that's one of the things, is that it is abstinence only in Hobbs, and I don't think that, you know, there's any kind of sex education going on for the kids in schools. So there's actually a wonderful nonprofit that was started down there by a young woman who moved there and a bunch of volunteers called My Power, and they're really trying to work with fifth and sixth grade girls to talk to them just about... you know, issues that are impacting them and body image and trying to build their confidence and what are their options as they grow older and that sort of thing. And so that the idea of it is that by the time a girl reaches junior high and high school, she'll have the confidence and she'll have the knowledge to make good decisions for herself, whatever she chooses to do. So that's
I would like to see a novel or a movie or a series of stories based on real life about what those interactions are really like. Like, what is happening with these girls? Are they having sex before they're ready? You know, are they just, do they just really not know the consequences and it just feels good so they do it? You know, like, what's really happening in these teenage girls'
lives?
Right,
right. And that's a great question. And part of what we're trying to do, we're going to do this summer, what we're calling community conversations, which is to go around the state to different communities and really talk to girls and see and maybe survey them. And what is it like to be a girl in New Mexico in this time and age? And what are some of your challenges? And what are the things you long for? And what are the things that make you sad? And those kinds of things, so that we can really understand what it is like to be a girl in 2012 in New Mexico.
Yeah.
And then look at ways that we can focus our efforts to draw attention to what those things are and to bring resources to them. We hope to be able to make grants. There's a lot of wonderful organizations out there all around the state of New Mexico doing wonderful work for women and girls. Again, they're kind of isolated and siloed a little bit because a lot of times they don't know what other groups are doing. They're in different parts of the state. And so we're hoping to kind of harness all those resources and bring them together and really help provide some leadership. We also thought it would be good, because there isn't anything like this, to do a research, sort of a research paper, but really bring together that kind of information you're just asking about. What is really happening in all different sectors, because it's all interrelated, right? The economic status in their household, whether or not a father is present, whether or not they have, are they going to school? Can they get to school? You know, what are their peers saying to them about what they should be doing or not doing? What are the cultural expectations? All those things are interrelated. And so we're pulling together a study to really understand what is, first of all, really understand what is the status. Like, how do we compare nationally to the lives of women and girls? And then also, what are the areas that really need focus and attention? And there's a lot of different groups working on this. And we're hoping to sort of be sort of the leader in that and sort of the connector between all those groups and help hopefully raise funds to show that we are all connected as women and girls in New Mexico, and we want to see our sisters, our New Mexico sisters, do well here and have opportunities
the idea that there might be some opportunities for these young women once they become adults, and that they could do something interesting with their lives besides having kids, in addition to having kids, or even instead of having kids right away, is something that maybe is kind of news to some people.
Yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, I don't think that the general public realizes how it is for women and girls in the state in general. One in five women in the state live in poverty, and we still, just like on our national colleagues, women are still paid 79 cents on the dollar for what men are paid here. And one in four women will experience sexual assault in New Mexico in their lifetime. And so I think, first of all, people need to understand or know that that's what a lot of our women and girls are up against. And then I think we need to make sure that they feel that they have opportunities and that they have ways to make the choices they want to make for their life, whether it's to have a child young or not, whether it's to go to college or start working. I mean, we're not trying to dictate to anyone what they should do with their lives. It's more giving them the confidence to know that they can do something different, or maybe something different than what their family has done in the past, and that they have the ability and the means to get there. I was listening to a video the other day about education, and it was talking to a lot of youth who were in an urban center, I think it was in Chicago, who came from poor neighborhoods, and they were talking about going to college, and these kids were laughing. They were like, I'm not college material. I could never go to college. I don't have the means to go to college. And so it's really helping people and children understand that if that's what they want to do, that there's a way for them to do it.
I mean, yeah, go to Artesia.
Go to Artesia.
Get a scholarship.
Exactly. That's part of everyone's plan. Let's move to Artesia.
No, I don't mean to make light of it. Yeah, well, another thing that the New Mexico Community Foundation funds and focuses on is domestic abuse and shelters for women and families.
Yeah, we actually, we have an emergency fund. We were just down in Silver City, like I said, and we went to a domestic abuse shelter, and they see about 30 to 40 families a year, and these are women who have left their abuser with their children often and need a place to go. And so they have this wonderful shelter down there, and when the women are ready to leave and to set up their household, a lot of times they have nothing. They, you know, the shelter will help them find a job, which they'll do, and yet they still have to set up a household, and that costs money. And so we have a fund that grants directly to them and helps them buy things like dishes and, you know, sheets for a bed and that sort of thing, and set up a whole new life for themselves. And so it's a really little things. I mean, these are not big grants. These are little grants. These are like $1,000, but they make a big difference and they go a long way.
Yeah.
And that's something I just really want to emphasize, is that it doesn't have to, like I said, everyone can be a philanthropist. It doesn't have to be a lot of money. A little bit of money can go a long way and make a big difference.
What are some other examples of that? I mean, when you think about, as the director of a foundation, what are the places where giving a little bit can really change people's lives?
Well, there's really lots of examples. I mean, you know, giving $20 to a food bank during the summertime can assure that kids get, several kids get backpacks filled with food that will help them. You know, some of the worst periods for children who suffer from hunger is during the summertime, because they don't have school and school meals to help fill that period. And so working with the local food bank, or even through the schools have some programs, you know, $20 can make a big difference that way. We also have funded the Breast Cancer Resource Center, which tries to help women who don't have any means really to get to Albuquerque to get the cancer treatment they need. And so gas cards, I mean, something as simple as paying for gas for someone, like, you know, we had a guy come in who they needed to go get their mother from Texas and bring her back up here because she had had some treatment in Texas and they didn't have money for gas. And so we were able to give them a grant for, you know, $150. And the guy came in, he was crying. He was so grateful for this kind of help. So these are people who are really on the edge and who any little bit can help them. And then, like I said, the whole planning of the Santa Clara canyon with the $5 and $10 donations to buy seedlings. Little bitty amounts of money can make a big difference.
And have you seen the seedlings and the planting?
I've seen pictures of them. They actually have to grow them here in New Mexico at Santa Clara. You can't like ship them in or something because they won't survive. They really need to be seedlings from this climate and this this area. And so they have a big greenhouse now, and they're growing the seedlings. And the kids from the Pueblo are going to actually help plant the seedlings, but we're talking hundreds and hundreds, so they probably won't plant all of them, but the idea is that they'll grow over time, and that those children who help plant them will be able to say, hey, when I was a little kid, I planted this tree, or say to the grandchildren someday. When I was a little kid, I planted this tree.
Now, there are also programs for Native American young people to help them stay in college.
Yeah, we have, the New Mexico Community Foundation has a new fund that is really looking at the problem of the Native dropout rate in college. A very small percentage of Native students actually go on to college, and then those that do drop out at a very, very high rate. And
what's that all about?
Well, there's a whole lot of different reasons. I mean, I think that part of it is, you know, really being ready for college. You know, college is hard for anybody, and so you can think back on your own freshman year or something. And
Horrible,
right? You probably wanted to quit. But you add on top of that, especially if a Native student has been living on the Pueblo or has been they're so tied to their culture and they don't have any kind of support around that. And if they leave the state, you know, it's a difficult time. So there's a lot of reasons for it. What we're trying to do is we're trying to work with a variety of groups here that are already working on this issue. And we're looking to hold a kind of a summit or a meeting later this fall to bring together a lot of the Native education directors and individuals who both have been really successful in college and those who maybe haven't, to really understand what's unique about New Mexico, and then to help fund different projects to help kids stay in school. We have a wonderful resource right here in Santa Fe. This is the Santa Fe Indian School, and they have a leadership institute, and they've got a program that they're already working on to help kids who are going to colleges out of state. And then there's certain colleges like Dartmouth that has a huge program that really tries to support Native students. And a lot of...
Who would have thought Dartmouth? That's so New England WASP.
It is. It's something I've just learned recently. But, you know, Alvin Warren went to Dartmouth, and Carnell Choza, who's at the Santa Fe Institute, and a lot of wonderful people from New Mexico have gone there, and they really try to support Native students from all over the country.
And so presumably there's some sense of, even if it's not your own, you know, your own Pueblo, your own tribe, of Native community that probably have more commonality with each other than they might with some of the other students.
Exactly. And then, you know, really trying to provide them with that support from home and letting them know they're not alone and that sort of thing. I mean, you know, Native Americans are a big part of our population, but when you look at it on a national level, it's a very small percentage of the population. And so I think they often feel isolated. And also, you know, not having the family support and the cultural support that they're used to is, I think, very challenging.
We're talking to Jenny Parks of the New Mexico Community Foundation. Now, you also have some programs that help animals.
We do. We do. We have the biggest one right now that we've been working on a lot is the Equine Protection Fund. And there's a big problem in New Mexico and really in the whole country on two levels. One is with the economic downturn, a lot of people who have horses, and New Mexico is a pretty big horse state, haven't been able to care for them in the ways that they need to be cared for. In other words, you know, feeding them, getting them, you know, vet visits, all that's very expensive. And so this fund was set up, the Equine Protection Fund, to really help provide immediate assistance for food assistance for horses and other equine, you know, donkeys and burros. In addition to that, there's, of course, which you've probably read in the paper a lot about lately, is the slaughter problem and the taking horses down to Mexico for slaughter. And so there's a lot of work going on that front as well. And so the Equine Protection Fund provides funding to help in this emergency situation and also helps for advocacy for the slaughter.
The whole question of dealing with cruelty is something that sometimes you don't even know where to start.
Well, I think just as I was talking about, you know, our human nature having that goodness in it and the generosity, I think there's also that aspect to ourselves as well. And as times get tough and people are stressed because of you know, losing their jobs or difficulties in their family, I think that can bring out a lack of empathy for others or animals and a certain amount of cruelty. And so I think that's a part of our human nature that's never going to go away, really. It's been there from the beginning and it'll probably always be there. But I do think that there's groups that, especially around animals, that try to help prevent that kind of animal cruelty or address it in very hands-on ways by, you know, rescuing animals, taking animals out of bad situations. You know, there's wonderful shelters that take all different kinds of animals where cruelty is evident. So there's a lot going on in that area that people do out of the generosity of their hearts and because they don't want to see our state kind of plagued by that kind of animal cruelty.
It's interesting when you, you talk about all these projects, and as a community foundation, not only are you giving money, but you're also involved in, presumably to some extent, in overseeing the project and providing assistance to help people do these projects. It's not just giving the money and walking away.
Very much so. I mean, our organization, we really try to walk hand in hand with our citizen, our communities, and our nonprofits. And three of our lenses that we kind of work through is, does it have a rural impact? Is it helping to cultivate local leadership? Because we certainly don't want to come in and tell different communities how they should do things or what they should do. We want to instead foster that local sense of ownership and leadership around different issues. And then, is it helping to bring equity where perhaps there wasn't any? And we don't see ourselves as a foundation that just writes a check and gives it. We really see it as walking with community, being a part of that community, and trying to help address these problems from the ground up, because that's really the only way they're going to get solved. And so we really believe in that partnership, in the power of the partnership, and it's really helped us be a very dynamic partner for almost 30 years now. So we're going to continue.
Well, in 30 years, you can do a lot of learning from what you've seen, presumably from mistakes that you make and that others make, and bring that knowledge to the next group that you work with.
Absolutely. And we're a learning organization, so I think we always will be learning. And each, you know, each community is unique in its own way, and each issue or problem you're trying to address is unique in its own way. And so I think that the learning never stops, really, and I also think that the power of a group of people to make something happen never stops. I mean, nothing of really any significance happens just by one person. It really takes a group effort, sometimes a cast of hundreds, and sometimes many, many years. But we really hold a long view when you're dealing with some of these deeper social problems. They're not overnight solutions, but I don't give up hope either. I think none of us can. I mean, we have a state that has a lot of social problems, that, as we know, we rank poorly in a lot of areas, but there's a lot of people doing a lot of work to try to change that right now. And so that's the good news. It's a very vibrant nonprofit community in New Mexico. We have some very big national partners that are focusing, including the Kellogg Foundation, who has chosen New Mexico as one of three states that they're going to really focus on.
that's great, but it probably also shows that.
Right. That's the good news and the bad news, right, is that we need a Kellogg. But, and other big national foundations have helped a lot here, too. And then the other part of it that's really important is that public-private partnership and really trying to work with the state and, you know, local governments to help solve some of these issues. And I think there's some good partnerships, especially on the county and city level, of working with nonprofits to help them fill some of that net we talked about. And I think that the state is also open to doing that, as well as, you know, our finances improve on the state level.
And you also allow groups that aren't nonprofits in their own right to use you as the kind of umbrella organization, fiscal, and you become their fiscal sponsors.
That's correct. We call it sort of like, we sort of incubate. We incubate nonprofits. A lot of groups either are not ready to become a nonprofit, or they are, and it takes some time to file the paperwork and get your 501c3 status. So we will provide that 501c3 umbrella to them, and we provide all of the back office support. So we do all of the accounting, gift acknowledgement. We also try to provide some technical assistance around what it takes to be a nonprofit, and how to build a board, and how do you fundraise, and what are some of the activities that you need to do to make sure that you're in compliance. And then we also try to help connect them to each other, so that if someone's starting has a great idea about doing something around animal protection, that we can connect them with other folks doing stuff around animal protection so that we're not creating two new nonprofits when there really doesn't need to be one.
That does seem to be a problem in New Mexico and almost everywhere, is a lot of different nonprofits doing virtually the same thing.
Or very similar things.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, in some ways it's because there's no one knows that other people are doing kind of what they're doing. Sometimes I think that there's something, everyone feels like their mission is so unique or so specific that they can't work with other people. I think that there's a lot of room for more collaboration and more synchronizing efforts. And actually, there'll be a lot more power that way. One of the groups that we worked with extensively over the last couple of years is that group called Women Building Community. And they were a true collaborative. They came together. And in the end, they ended up partnering with all different kinds of organizations that were working on women's and girls' reproductive justice issues. And they organized themselves for the first time ever, and were able to actually present a kind of a united front and platform at the state legislature this last year. And so that was a wonderful example of groups with similar goals and purposes coming together and working together. And I think it's the way of the future. I think the conservation community has done that many times over the past to try to either prevent bad legislation or to get good legislation passed at the legislature. And I think more and more groups are doing that.
Now, when people come to you looking for grants, looking for support, how do you evaluate whether they're worthy of receiving those grants?
Well, a lot of our grants are through our donors. So they're donor advised or they're through a specific program. And so a lot of times the donor will choose who they want to give to.
Or
they will say, I want to give to a group that supports animal welfare. And then we will research for them the different groups that are doing animal welfare and look at their financials, look at their board, look at their results, really, and see how they have done, and then make recommendations to the donor. So we really kind of consider ourselves nonprofit experts that can really help a donor meet their philanthropic goals. We also have specific programs that are funded from individuals or from other foundations that have certain criteria. For example, we just gave out almost $220,000 in grants to organizations around the state that were working on river restoration or river conservation. And the donor, it was a one-time gift from a donor, and her only instruction to us was, I want to see this go to organizations that are helping protect New Mexico rivers. And so we had an advisory council that came, of volunteers that came up with the criterion, and then we scored them and were able to give out grants really all over the state to just do just that.
Very interesting. And so you have, I mean, we've talked about giving $5 for a seedling to plant in Santa Clara, but you also have some really major donors.
We do.
Giving a lot of money.
We do. And we want to service all of them because we need all of them and the state needs all of them. So we help people who may have a lot of means, but may not have a lot of knowledge about what's happening in the nonprofit sector in New Mexico. And we can help connect people who may not have a lot of means, but have knowledge and would like a little assistance or a little extra help in making their decisions on how to fulfill their philanthropic desires.
Now, when I look at the reality of all these wonderful projects and what you're doing and what many groups that we have on the air are doing, there is this great goodwill. And then on the other side, there's all this greed and, above all, environmental destruction that's going on, some of which is due to greed and some of which is due to stupidity or neglect or just too many people using too few resources or whatever. And when you look at the balance of people doing all these great things, it seems to me when I look at it that the dominant force is still that destructiveness.
You know, I have to think about that is think how bad it would be if you didn't have all the good going on, because you can get discouraged, right? We've ranked poorly on a number of areas for a long time, and there's been a lot of work done. But if we didn't have these people working for the greater good and dedicating their lives really to improve the lives of others, I don't even like to think of where we'd be. So I try to think about it in that way.
Jenny Parks is the president and CEO of the New Mexico Community Foundation. They're on the web at nmcf.org. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Mary Charlotte.